Prepare to be astonished.
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Hello, hello. We are so glad you're joining us once again as we round out the month of April. I say it often, but I can't believe that this month's almost over.
You sound like those clips of newscasters.
Yes.
When they're...
Can't imagine where that came from.
It's making fun of that. Like, I can't believe that it's already time for school. I can't believe summer's over.
But it's
true. St. Patrick's Day. I can't believe.
I mean, folks, are you ready to write May? Because it's this week.
I think we're all ready.
Okay. Max ready. I'm not.
Yeah, that's because you've been on vacation.
Oh, that's true. I do love going on my little trips, of course.
Yeah. All right. Well, we got a whole bunch of things coming up, speaking of May.
Okay.
So
what's going on?
Old-fashioned fun and games, May 3rd and 4th.
My favorite.
It is fantastic.
And free.
Of course, it's free because it's sponsored by our friends at Columbia Memorial Hospital. Although one year, you know, we do sell some concessions, and they're dirt cheap.
Like a dollar or 50 cents.
I think the most expensive thing is a dollar.
Yeah.
But we do that mostly for the volunteers, but invariably when families hang around and they're waiting for the ice cream demonstration, they're waiting for the potato sack contest, they'll come over for a corn dog or a pretzel or lemonade or popcorn. And one year I had somebody that it was advertised as free.
Oh no. And the $1.25 meal.
And I was like, okay, everything on the grounds is free. All these demonstrations, your kids are going to eat because ice cream, here's some ice cream.
Yes.
Butter, here's some crackers and butter. Apple press, okay, here's some apple juice. I'm sorry we're charging 50 cents for popcorn.
Right.
I'm sorry we're charging a dollar for a corn dog.
Oh, and it's so nice. I mean, we plan a lunch around it.
A lot of people do.
For a family, because it is all families. It's all ages, too, because I have noticed, like, even older kids still show up.
Oh, yeah. And they get a little disappointed, especially the ones that have come for years and years and years of, why can't I enter the potato sack race?
Oh.
And I'm like, because...
You're going to win.
You're going to win, and at some point we have to just... Let it go because you're 14 now.
At some point, Carly can't beat everybody over and over.
She's very understanding, though.
When
I say you can still participate, but you're not going to win.
Yeah, that's true.
Well,
she has a little sister, right?
Help the little kids. Yeah. Although if she didn't have her little sister there, she might be a little more cutthroat.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, that's when we sign her up to like volunteer at one of those moves.
Because there's a look of determination on her face and things like that. All right. Then the following week, Saturday, May 10th, is Mother's Day Tea and Scones.
Yes.
And again, I said Saturday.
Yep, just Saturday.
Yeah.
Reservations are
required.
Required.
And we don't ask our volunteers to come in on Mother's Day to serve this, so that's why we do it on Saturday, and it's in the afternoon. Then Thursday Night Talks is the third Thursday, and May 15th. And this is going to be really great. It's Zachary Stocks from Oregon Black Pioneers.
One of our favorite guests.
He's a great guest, great speaker, really just energetic, but he loves railroad history.
Oh, fun.
Yeah, and he's been researching, you know, the dedication of the Astoria Column 99 years ago. It was the culmination of a giant railroad trip.
Okay.
And they stopped because they had all these monuments, not as grand by any fraction of what the column is.
Right.
But they stopped at each one, and governors were there and Native Americans, and they would have local students having contests. And it was this giant long railroad trip to kind of dedicate them all, but to get to here and to dedicate the column.
Oh, I love that.
So he's going to talk about that railroad trip.
Okay, good.
And then that's on May 15th.
And he's a great speaker.
Yes.
Yeah, very entertaining.
Yeah, you should get there early. And then, of course, Goonies Day, June 7th.
Ooh, fun.
So, lots of stuff coming up.
Yeah, Goonies Day is exciting. And I have Vintage Slang.
All right.
Still trying it out. This one's a noun.
Are you going to, should I get ready for the buzzer? Because last week you use very inappropriate language.
I know, right? I had no idea.
If you were on the streets in certain towns in the 1800s.
It's actually in front of me. I'm not going to say it, but yeah. And these are like giant flashcards, so you can actually see the word, but this is a person, place, or a thing, and it's duck soup.
Duck soup.
Yep.
I think that is something like eating crow.
Ooh.
It's like, oh, if you have to, I'm embarrassed or I was wrong.
That's duck soup.
You're eating duck soup.
That's a good guess. But no, this one is it's a cinch, a piece of cake.
Wow.
My trig homework was duck soup.
It was duck soup.
Duck soup. Easy.
Easy.
Which making duck soup does not sound easy, but...
You would think it'd be like chicken noodle soup.
It is slang.
Actually, you think it'd be like tomato soup.
Yeah. Okay. So, duck soup.
Duck soup. That's not coming back. All right. History highlight of the day. Things that happen tomorrow, April 28th.
Okay.
1789. Mutiny on the HMS Bounty.
Yep. Saw that one.
Yeah.
It's a big one.
I like that story. 1881, Billy the Kid escapes from the Lincoln County Jail in Lincoln, New Mexico.
Oh.
So my first trip, because I'm a huge Billy the Kid fan.
And New Mexico fan.
My first trip to Lincoln County, and the entire town is historic, even though people live there. But I took pictures of myself in all the places that people were shot during the Lincoln County War. So there I am lying in the street where Billy shot the deputy.
Were...
Oh, of course. And then here's the deputy right outside the window that got shot. And then here's this guy. I'm like just lying in each place as if I just got shot.
So how old was Billy the Kid? Do you know?
Yeah, he was about 21, 23.
Okay, so he was young.
He was young.
But
yes.
Not a kid.
No.
Yeah.
And did not kill as many people as history romanticized.
Okay.
He was a killer, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
And if you've seen the movie Young Guns with Emilio Estevez, while John Fusco, the writer, certainly takes some liberties, and I think they're logical liberties to bring that story into a movie format,
sure,
the portrayal of Emilio Estevez as Billy the Kid is dead on.
Oh, okay.
You know, here's this cold-blooded killer, and you know, hey, he just shot that guy, and he really shouldn't have. And yet there's something still very endearing about
him. A connection.
That you know, this guy is funny or he's charming. And I think that was Billy the Kid.
Huh. Okay. Good to know. Right.
1916, luxury car magnate Ferruccio Lamborghini is born.
Oh, I saw that one. Yeah.
Yeah. Not that I have a Lamborghini.
I know, right?
Or have ever sat in a Lamborghini or even care about Lamborghini. 1945, Benito Mussolini is executed.
Well, yes.
How do we feel about that?
I'm okay with that. Yeah.
Okay. 1947, Thor Heyerdahl and the crew of the Contiki sail from Peru to Polynesia, proving that that's how, like, Easter Island and all those other places, that they could have just left South America
and just gone.
All right. 1967. Of course, I could make a joke about Thor here. But, all right. 1967. I've already done that once on the air. 1967. Muhammad Ali refuses induction into the army and he's stripped of his boxing title.
Ooh. Yeah.
So yeah, 1926, though, the history highlight of the day, I think had the most impact on history because there's not a lot on my list here.
Right. There's not.
So 1926, Harper Lee is born to Kill a Mockingbird.
Mm-hmm.
And for no apparent reason, my favorite quote about To Kill a Mockingbird actually comes from The Simpsons and Homer Simpson.
Yeah, of course it does.
Books are useless. I only ever read one book, To Kill a Mockingbird, and it gave me absolutely no insight on how to kill mockingbirds.
Yeah.
Sure, it taught me not to judge a man by the color of his skin, but what good does that do me?
Oh my gosh.
I saw that as a kid and it made me laugh. And I tracked the quote down just
because it stayed with you.
Yeah, it stayed with me.
More than the quotes from the
But obviously The Kill a Mockingbird, the movie, the book, just had
big deal.
Such a huge impact.
You know, I saw that one and my one takeaway too was I remember when her estate found that next book and it was unfinished. And then sort of hastily published, probably with a ghostwriter, I think. But people were very disappointed at the writing, right? And they were disappointed at the storytelling. And yet I think, really? Here's somebody that wrote something that was so amazing. Mm-hmm. And you think everything that comes out
this is
gonna
be as
absolutely
good.
Yes. Perfect? I mean, writers will never tell you that they've just written one book.
And I'm
right?
done.
Yeah. They write 20 or they write 100 and one gets published. Or in their mind, they have all these stories. I mean, I just remember it. I found it so shocking that people were shocked.
Yes.
That, and it was, and I never have read it. I didn't, you know, all I needed to hear too, that it wasn't a great book. And I'm like, okay, I believe you. Don't need to read that.
But yeah. I've never been inclined either to
read what to read isn't it. Good. I mean, yeah. Because we know she did.
And maybe it is great though. And everyone just.
That's true too.
Because if maybe To Kill a Mockingbird, let's say on a scale of 1 to 100 is 100. Maybe the other book is a 90.
True. Well, and in the time written, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird probably was not as popular. Mm-hmm. Certainly, it's become easier to talk about. There was one more little fact of the day, which was just,
yeah,
was just a goofy one. It's certainly not very important. But in 1953, inventor Howard Ross receives a patent for a double coat. And this is an outer layer that can be extended to cover two people. The intended use, you ask?
Yeah, you're like at the baseball game.
To protect spectators in an athletic stadium, specifically baseball, when it rains. A patent for a double coat. I was like, so I had to keep clicking.
What year was that?
1953.
Oh, I was going to say, that's why they don't say football, why they say baseball.
Oh, okay.
Just not as popular yet.
At that, yeah, outdoor.
But when you think of cold and sitting outside, I think more football
right. When
I do a baseball.
But the last thing I want to do is share a coat with somebody. Yes. How about just my coat?
That's right. How about just make it my coat warm?
Well, Howard, good try. Good try.
Good try, Howard. It'd be funny if we learned that, like, he actually made a fortune off of this somehow.
Right.
It's just the fad is gone and we're just not familiar
with it.
It's like
the Snuggie of that time period.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so we had a Thursday night talk a couple weeks ago. Really good and good attendance. And it was about Steve Fick's distillery there, the mm-hmm. brick warehouse behind the Burger King, the Astoria Waterfront Warehouse. I can't remember the official name of it. But it was a bonded warehouse. And that led to a discussion because people were like, what does that mean? And the speakers talked about what that means. So we talked about tariffs a little bit. So I thought, hey, tariffs have been in the news.
They have.
I'm curious to learn more about tariffs.
Okay.
So I went to our website, the museum website, AstoriaMuseums.org, and under Explore, of course, there's the Internet Archive of all the things, over 4,000 collections now that we have scanned.
Love that.
In collaboration with over 15 different local organizations. And I typed in the word tariff, and I thought I was going to get something, you know, an article that we'd written in Cumtux about the Customs House. But when I hit tariffs first, and I was going to go to customs next, we had one document that popped up. So, of course, I opened it up and I started reading it. And it was really interesting. So I thought that we'd kind of explore this document a little bit. And it's called Collecting the Customs. And this is the summary history of the development of the tariff in the United States and its administration. And it's dated August 1st, 1939.
Okay.
And it's the 150th anniversary of the first federal tariff and the organization of the Customs Service. It's about a 40-page document. So this is going to be an extended radio show. You'll be up till midnight listening to it. No, I'm kidding. But if we don't finish this, because there's a lot of different interesting aspects to this, at least to me, if we don't finish this, you can go online.
I love that.
I gave you the instructions. And you could just call this document up yourself.
Yeah.
So if you really don't like listening to Mac and Alana, you can actually just turn the radio off right now and go look it up yourself and read it.
But, oh, heaven forbid.
But that would not be as entertaining.
Exactly. So let's start. We're going to start. This is the page one, and it's the School of Instruction, Bureau of Customs. Attached is a paper issued as a press release prepared in the Division of Public Relations, Treasury Department, on the 150th anniversary of the organization of the United States Customs Service under the Constitution and passage of the first Federal Tariff Act of July 4th, 1789. This compilation is a factual recitation of the beginnings of the United States Customs Service, which was the principal steps and events in its organization and development, together with human interest stories and a radio address prepared by the School of Instruction. The compilation contains some interesting material, which could be used in public speeches and radio addresses or in newspaper and magazine articles. It is largely based upon official publications and documents, which are cited.
Radio addresses, they knew.
Yeah.
But I'm more interested, and you don't have the entire thing in front of you. I've only printed out some of it.
Okay.
But a 35-page press release.
Oh, yeah. It's amazing.
It's really a study or a report at this point. It's really not a press release, but that makes me laugh. So collecting the customs beginnings, the United States customs was 150 years old in this year, 1939, a method already long tried and accepted of raising revenue for governments. The collection of custom duties was a natural course for the new republic that had exhausted its finances to achieve independence. The draft of the first tariff had been prepared before the first Congress, which assembled in New York on March 4th, 1789, had finished its initial task of electing the first president. So this is already before they even have the president yet. They've been writing some laws here to create tariffs. On April 14th of that year, a delegation from the Congress arrived at Mount Vernon and notified George Washington he had been chosen for the presidency. Washington took his oath April 30th. A month later, on June 1st, 1789, he signs the first piece of legislation of the first Congress. And you would hope that that would have been like tariffs for this conversation. It wasn't. It was about taking the oath of office, that that all elected people take an oath to defend and support the Constitution of the United States. Each appointee of the Customs Service is actually also swears the same oath that was the first thing that Washington signed. It was more than a month later, while the young nation was celebrating the 13th anniversary of its independence, that President Washington signed his second law of the first Congress, an act for laying a duty on goods, wares, and merchandises imported into the United States. A tariff. This act was approved July 4th, 1789. The several duties listed were to be laid, the senators and representatives declared, quote, from and after the first day of August, next ensuing.
You know what I find interesting here? Mm-hmm. In that first paragraph, they credit why this had to happen and why it was a good thing. Mm-hmm. And so what they wrote here is the collections of customs duties was a natural course for the new republic that it exhausted its finances to achieve independence.
Oh, yeah. We were broke.
I mean, that's a very flavorful sentence right there of this is a good thing to charge people because we had to spend all your money fighting.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there were soldiers that were owed like 4 years back.
Oh, man.
They were just fighting.
But sometimes there are purposes behind taxes.
Yeah. So you want to talk about the origin of tariff?
Let's do it. Yes. The word tariff was born out of bloodshed and plunder. It comes from the little town on the coast of Spain near Gibraltar called Tarifa. It received its present name from the Arabs who are said to have named it after the Tariff of Calic, who in July 710 was sent by Tariq to
reconnaissance.
Okay, the country. Yes. So the existence of this historic town can be traced back to at least 12 centuries. Tariffs, like Gibraltar, is high on the promontory and is connected with the coast only by a narrow causeway easily defended. When the Moors, many centuries ago, founded the town of Tarifa, they prepared the way for a system that is probably the most important factor in international trade. As the name suggests, the factor is the tariff.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
It comes from the name of a town.
Interesting. In the days when commerce began to spread from the Mediterranean, there was a gang, the racketeers, we call them today, who made Tarifa their headquarters. They watched from this point, held up all merchant vessels, and levied tribute according to a fixed scale on all merchandise passing in or out of the straits. This tribute at Tarifa was called by mariners, a tariff, and the word became current in England, whose vessels formed a majority in the merchant trade. The word was adopted, doubtless for the same reason, into Spanish, tarifa, Portuguese, French, and Italian, all very similar. The government of Europe began making similar levies on imports, and tariffs became a prolific source of revenue. The tariff system was already fully established in the Old World when the American colonies were founded. In the days of the Moors, the tariff was little better than a holdup. The fierce fighters of Tarifa levied tribute at will. Because of its position and the steady and fruitful source of revenue it controlled, Tarifa was the scene of much warfare and changed hands many times during its early history.
I love that. And I love that the guys were called the racketeers.
Right.
what a racket this is. You're just taking money from us. All right. So the American colonial days. For 75 years before the Revolution, there was annual trade trade, there was an annual trade balance against the American colonies and in favor of Great Britain. Well, of course, because we were colonies. It was estimated in 1754 that the colonies ran behind annually to the extent of $1 million. In 1760, the colonies imported more than they exported to the extent of about $9 million. Not a large total, according to the standards of today, but to the colonials of 1760, it was a staggering sum. These debts were carried along an open credit or transferred into the more solid form of mortgages. There was hardly any English money in circulation in the colonies. Instead of sending money across the sea, the merchants and moneylenders of London wanted money sent to them to cover past due indebtedness. The result was that America was always drained of English currency.
Interesting.
Lord Cornwallis surrendered in 1781. His troops marched out of Yorktown to a tune called "The World Turned Upside Down." The American Revolution ended officially in 1783 with the signing on September 3rd of the Treaty of Paris. From then until March 4th of 1789, this country was not a nation. People forget that. Oh. It was a small set of independent nations, each jealous of the other. They were independent states.
Right. Trying to figure out what to do.
When it came to taxation, the Continental government was a pleading pauper. The Congress did not have the power to levy taxes directly. It made requisitions on these states. Like, hey, New Jersey, do you mind paying? Can you pay for this? In proportion to the assessed value of their land.
Mm.
As a rule, the states ignored the requisitions, and there was nothing to be done about it. At one time, the Treasury did not possess a dollar.
Wow.
In 1781, the Continental government needed $9 million. The Congress hoped to raise $4 million in loans, and $5 million was asked of the states. Only $442,000 was collected from the states, none of which came from the Carolinas, Georgia, or Delaware. Really? Come on, Carolinas, Georgia, and Delaware. however, the Congress could issue bonds or certificates of indebtedness. These issues depreciated at once, as there was nothing back to back them but a promise.
Right.
So every state had a different tariff law, and some states set up tariffs against neighboring states.
Oh, my goodness. So let's print some money. Let's talk about that. The Congress had no legislative power over individuals. It acts applied only to the states. Thus, there was no federal code of civil or criminal law. Almost any public authority could issue paper money. The states all had their special brands of currency, and the Congress issued continental money. Besides the bewildering varieties of the native product, foreign money was in circulation. All of it except metal coin was in active depreciation. There was continual bickering among the states. The causes of discord were often so trivial as to make the disputes seem improbable to later generations. The row between New York on one side and Connecticut and New Jersey on the other is an example. The New York legislature came to the conclusion that too much money was going from New York City into the pockets of Connecticut Yankees and Jersey men. Connecticut supplied most of New York's firewood, and the farmers of New Jersey sent boatloads of vegetables, chicken, and eggs to the metropolis across the river. New York enacted a tariff law and placed a heavy duty on these humble products. Every chicken peddler from New Jersey had to take his fowl to the custom house, have them valued, and obtain clearance papers. Eggs were counted. Connecticut firewood was measured. Cabbages were appraised. Duties had to be paid on everything. Now, that's an interesting way of doing it, because there's a cost to that, too, right?
Yeah.
There is still conflicts between the states. New Jersey arose in wrath. The city of New York owned a lighthouse on Sandy Hook. The New Jersey legislature levied a tax of $1,800 a year on it. Connecticut merchants decided to boycott New York. They formed an association and bound themselves under penalties not to buy or sell in the city. Ooh. In 1783, Great Britain proclaimed that all cargoes in the West Indian trade must be carried in British ships. In retaliation, New York laid a double duty on goods imported in British vessels, and Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Rhode Island prohibited British ships from carrying cargoes out of their harbors. Connecticut took thrifty advantage of the situation. She threw her ports open, duty-free, to British commerce. This annoyed the neighbors. She followed it up by imposing a tariff on all goods coming into Connecticut from Massachusetts. That was even more annoying. Marilyn claimed the width of the Potomac River. Her learned men, assisted by others not so learned, contended on the strength of antique charters that a vessel at a wharf on the Virginia shore of the Potomac was in Maryland territory.
I love that. We own both sides of the river.
In the water. Virginia ridiculed this assertion and, in turn, tried to collect fees from every vessel entering Chesapeake Bay. The reason was that Virginia owned the lighthouse on both sides of the mouth of the Chesapeake. After a long dispute and loss of temper, the matter was adjusted.
So it goes on for a few pages with some of these examples. There's a huge one about the Wyoming Valley, which is kind of western Pennsylvania, and it's a beef between Pennsylvania, Connecticut, a little bit of Massachusetts and New York. So that goes on, but I wanted to get to this section before we run out of time. First Tariff Act of July 4th, 1789. 13 years after the signing of the Declaration of Independence of Philadelphia on July 4th, 1789, the first United States Tariff Act was signed at New York by George Washington. It became effective August 1st. James Madison, a free trader, proposed the tariff measure as a temporary expedient intended to provide operation revenues. Madison's plan was a flat 5% levy on all imports, but protectionists wishing to encourage domestic protection amended the bill to provide higher levies. Duties were assessed against imports of beverages, foods, candles, steel and iron, carriages, harness, footwear, glass, furs, paper, spices, fruits, and canned products.
Wow. Yikes, that would hurt.
Yeah.
All the things that you need.
The debate on the bill was not without acrimony. There was not a little log rolling, according to the Journal of Senator William Maclay of Pennsylvania. Madison, on April 8th, offered a resolution levying duties on rum and spirituous liquors, molasses, wines, teas, pepper, sugar, cocoa, and coffee. The next day, as Fitzsimmons, a representative of Pennsylvania, offered an amendment adding 100 more articles to the Madison list.
When Washington signed the first Tariff Act, it contained Madison's items, those of Fitzsimmons, and many others offered in amendments by senators and representatives whose constituents resided in the industrial centers of the North. The South demanded production also, mainly for tobacco, cane products, hemp and coal, iron and steel. New England rum distillers wanted free trade in molasses. Southern producers favored a duty up to 6 cents per gallon. Pennsylvania brewers asked for a tax of 9 cents per gallon on beer in casks, but wanted beer bottles admitted free. Maryland demanded a glass tax to protect a vital industry. Virginia, then including West Virginia, sought protection for its coal mines, and tobacco growing states demanded a duty that ought to amount to a prohibition. This tariff act caused a great rejoicing throughout the country and in newspapers was referred to as the second Declaration of Independence. The next act of the Congress was a law placing tonnage taxes on vessels. The tariff act was a duty on merchandise. The other was a tax on common carriers. This distinction maintains to the present day.
As finally approved, the Tariff Act embraced a long list of specific duties and five classes of goods imposed with ad valorem rates. It contained a short free list, made provisions for the prepayment of all duties upon goods against exportations, and admitted the principle of discrimination in favor of commodities imported in vessels built or owned by citizens of the United States. So it goes on and on, and it's fascinating to me that a lot of these things I'm reading from 1939, reading the history, we're hearing in the newspapers and
still
on the radio today.
Yeah. So on the free list, I'm going to add this, was tin pigs and tin plates, wire dyes, and fur. Free.
Get your pigs free.
Yeah. Interesting.
Nobody wants to mess with bacon. So you can read this yourself on our website, but go make some history. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week.
Thank you for joining us for An Adventure in History. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.